Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Welcome to the Tattered Cover. We're so glad you joined us this evening. I'm not going to say a whole lot because she, how many of you already know her? She has such an interesting life, I think. I want it. but I can't have it. And we're going to hear tonight about Magnolia. Great cover. Okay. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Gives you a clue. So let's welcome her tonight.
Thank you.
I was just in the Denver Women's Press Club, and I had sort of like a little tiny sort of speech written out for them, and I started getting questions from the audience, and I went totally off the rails. But I was thinking maybe I should do what I did there, because they were fans of my Lupe Solano series. You know, they had not read this book, so they kept asking me questions. Wonderful ladies, maybe 15 or 20 of them, but they had all read my mysteries. They had not read this one. So I don't know how many of you have read my mysteries, because that's sort of what I'm known for. Or should I just delve into sex? I mean, what do you want me to do? You tell me how you want me to start, sex or mysteries. But anyway, I'll do a quick and dirty about how I started, and then I'll go into the sex, you know. When I go to listen to authors, and I do that a lot because I have a lot of friends who are writers now that I'm a writer, and I'm always interested how they got to be standing like here, you know, talking about a book, how they got started, what made them write, what made them start. And so I think I'll just start that way, how I got started, and then ease into, you know, the dirty stuff. Okay. I was born in Cuba, as the lady that introduced me said, very kindly, and we came into exile when I was a young child. I'd always read a lot of mysteries because that's the only field that really, really interested me. I was one of the youngest members of the Sherlock Holmes Society, and I started reading them in Spanish, you know, because I was little. I was like 9 or 10. And obviously then graduated to Nancy Drew. And, you know, I did whatever a little girl does when she likes mysteries. But I found that it was a mystery field that really, really interested me. One of the reasons for that is that there was a lot of chaos going on in my life. We had just left our country. We had gone to a different country, although I had been in the U.S. a few times, but, you know, not really in the state that we were in. And my parents split up. And so mysteries seemed to have a certain flow about them, because they all had justice at the end. I mean, always bad things happen to the bad guy in mysteries. If you read them all, you know, ta-da, you did it, you know, go to jail or get killed or whatever that is. And I kind of like that, because that was not happening in my life, you know, at all. So I always liked to write. And at college, I used to write other students' term papers. That's what I helped did for, you know, money and for cash, because my mother was not very free with cash, so I had to sort of support myself. And so I started writing papers and doing research, and I wrote quite a few papers for courses I never took. So that's how I learned how to do research. And, you know, back then you went to the card library and then you looked it up. All of you are too young, but, you know. And then you go to the stacks and you make the copy in the stacks, and then you come back and then you fight for the copy machine, you know, and it was a nickel back then. Okay, that's how old I am. Anyway, so that's how I started writing. I got the entire soccer team of my college through. I will not say who they are, but the coach was very happy with me. So anyway, so I went on in college. I was a history and political science major. I was a double major. I never got finished my master's at Georgetown. I started school, but I didn't finish. I have to clarify, but I do have an MBA. So I went the money route, you know, not the other route. So anyway, so I did that when to get to Magnolia, and not to Magnolia, to my mysteries, the Lupe Solano series. In 1986, I just had my third child, Gabriella, my baby. And I decided that I could write a book. And I'd read so many books at that point that I figured, why couldn't I write this? I mean, I've read just about every book there was in the mystery field, in the mystery genre. I felt like I knew everything to be able to write a book. So I sat down, I started writing what I thought was going to be a series. It was featuring a female private eye, Lupe Solano, as you spoke about. And but I really didn't have quite a handle on what the story was. At that point, I had been a guardian ad litem in the state of Florida for 8 years. I don't know if you know what a guardian is. It's a volunteer position, and you represent children in the courts, and you do investigations, and you're assigned, by a judge to investigate child abuse. And unfortunately, my specialty was incest, which is just not a specialty anybody wants to have, but that was mine. So I made friends who were in the justice system in Miami, and one of my friends was a prosecutor there, and he prosecuted the child abuse cases. Anyway, he left that post and went into private practice. And he was quite a successful criminal defense lawyer in Miami. So when I decided that I was going to write the Lupe Solano books, or, you know, a mystery book featuring a female PI, what I wanted to do was I was married. I had 3 children. My main preoccupation in life was carpooling. And here I am. Why are you going to write these mystery things? Anyway, so I went to him and I said, look, I want to consult with you. I know you use investigators in your private eye, in your business. You use PIs. What's the name of the firm that you go to and, who do your investigations? I said, I think I could just work in that office for maybe 6 months, and then I'll know everything there is to know about the private eye business in Miami. And then I will sit down, write a book in maybe 9 months, and, New York Times bestseller list is just waiting for me, Okay, that tells you where my head was back then. So I went and he gave me the name of a firm. It was a firm in the northwest section by the airport in Miami. If you're familiar with Miami, it's a lot of office buildings back there. And I interviewed, and this tells you the caliber of the firm. They hired me. they hired me. I was making $8 an hour. I never forget. I was making $8 an hour. I looked at my first paycheck. I said, what do I do with this? And 12 with overtime. So, but back then, it was at the time where there was not so much internet. If you were doing missing persons, you went and you banged on doors. If somebody was stealing from somebody else, you went and you talked to people. It was just totally, totally different. And I was really happy that I learned back then, because I learned from the ground up how to do this kind of stuff, which is necessary. I didn't want to be one of those writers that rides with a police officer for, 6 hours, and then they write the book and they know everything there is, because that's not the way it is at all. It's a lot of patient work and just reading files and going to the courthouse and just getting all dusty and having the clerk not give you the file. And how do you build, because you're lawyers, how do you build a client for time that you're just sitting there because the clerk doesn't give you the file? That's reality. That's life. That's the kind of stuff you do. Also, if you miss anything, it's on your back, and things happen. There are consequences to your actions. So I really kind of did. I'm not Mother Teresa, obviously, the way I put this, but you really had to learn. And I did the groundwork. I really did all that. Anyway, at the end of, I thought I was going to do this for 6 months, as I said before. When I was there, I met a man who was a federal officer with ATF, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and he was working in this law firm under some sort of a witness protection plan, because he had testified in a case in New York where really bad people were after him, like really bad people. So he was in Miami in this firm. We got to know each other because there were 7 men and me in this absolutely totally pathetic firm. Anyway, but they got a lot of work, because the head of the firm really knew how to schmooze and do all that. Anyway, so he and I got sent out in a lot of cases together that were like husband and wife or undercover. We were doing there was a jewelry, a ring of jewelry thieves who were stealing from men, and we would go and pretend to be engaged, to be married, and look at all the jewelry to see what had been stolen and where it wasn't pawned. Stupid stuff like that. In a hotel room, they were. The guy who did the mini bar was stealing, so I had to pretend to be a client drunk on the bed, and he was watching me from the next room to watch the mini bar guy steal my jewelry, fake, So, we did a lot of stuff together. We spent a lot of time together. Let me tell you. So he told me, he said he was thinking of leaving the agency at that point, and he said, you seem to have like a head for the kind of, a good, I guess sneaky is the right word. I was like good at this. And he said, why don't you apply for your PI license, and we'll open up a firm together. Well, I thought this was peachy keen. So we opened up the firm. He quit the day my license came in the mail. We quit the firm. I had my license downstairs. I also have business cards. But anyway, if this doesn't work out. So I went and... And, you know, we applied it. We opened up an office in, if you know Miami, it all was sort of by the Orange Bowl, the old Orange Bowl where they had the sports thing. And it was always a miracle. It was so low rent, so low rent. But it was always a miracle our cars were in the lot when we came out at night. It was that kind of a place. No view of Biscayne Bay anywhere, okay? We had a tire shop next door. So anyway, so we did that for, I did that for a couple of years. And then unfortunately, he went out on a case. And this is true. He went out on a case, undercover case, and he never came back. And I don't know what happened to him. Because he had his cases he worked, I had my cases that I worked, so I didn't know what he was involved in because we never discussed. You know, we talked about the office and how to run the office, but not the particulars. So after he disappeared, I tried to find him. I had no idea where he was or what happened. Anyway, so, and because he had been undercover, you know, with ATF, I couldn't go to anyone. And I still hope and pray that he's someplace, but it's probably unlikely. I Google him every so often. I try to find out where he went to. And so I kept the firm. I kept working as a private eye. I did this for 10 years. After 10 years, my husband said to me, he said, the book. I did this for 10 full years. I was amazingly successful as a private eye in Miami, mostly because I didn't have a drug habit, or I didn't steal from people, or I didn't have priors. You know, I could be relied on. I mean, this was Miami in 1986. There was this one, I remember this one case, it was one lawyer who had a serious, serious coke problem. And we had to testify in court. I mean, he had to testify, and I was there in case they had, you know, I had to help or whatever. And the blood was coming out of his nose. So he said, reset, ask for the reset, ask the bailiff for, you know, to change. And I said, no, we've been here three other times, we're going. So I go to the men's room in the courthouse, I washed him up, I stuck Kleenexes up his throat, and I would tell him what to say. And so we got, I mean, this was Miami in the 60s. This is what I was working on. It's not exactly highbrow, right? No wonder I write a dirty book. But actually, that train of thought never occurred to me till right now. But anyway, so did that for 10 years, and I told the ladies in the other place, asked me, why did you quit, or how do you know how you quit? And I told the story of how I quit. I had actually written up the story in an anthology called Miami Noir. And what had happened is, I am so not making this up, okay? You have to really believe me. This lawyer, the one with the, you know, that had got me onto the private eye case thing, he called me on a Friday afternoon and he said, you got to go to the, you have to go to the men's jail, you know, Miami-Dade County, the men's jail, because there's a client there, Mr. Tellez. I can say it now because he passed away, so I'm not bound by confidentiality. Because we have to go by under Florida Statute 492, because, you know, I'm a private eye, so anyway. So he said, Mr. Velez has been accused of killing his neighbor, but his English isn't so good. My Spanish is pretty terrible. So can you just go and interview him in the jail and find out what the deal is? I've offered him a plea. He won't take the plea. He says that he'll be fine, that the jury will acquit him, and it's a really tough case. I said, okay, well, I'll go to the jail. Okay, fine. So I go to the county jail. I am so not making this up. And Mr. Tellez is sitting there. He's a Cuban guy, about maybe 55 or 60 years old. And he had been accused of murdering his next door neighbor. Mr. Tellez was retired because he had like a bad, had a bad heart or high blood pressure. I don't know. He had some sort of health thing that he couldn't work. His wife, they didn't have any children. His wife was the one who worked. She worked in a factory, and she would go off every morning to the factory and come back every afternoon. They lived in Hialeah in Miami. If you know Miami, sort of like a working, Cuban working class neighborhood. Anyway, Mr. Tellez's next door neighbors were a gay couple, a man and his boyfriend, and one was a personal trainer, and the other one I can't recall what it is, what he was. Anyway, so they had a fight, and the boyfriend moved out, but the personal trainer stayed. He had a little dog, a little white dog. Every morning before the personal trainer went to work, he would walk across Mr. Tellez's yard to go to the park or wherever the dog went to the bathroom. But the dog used to poop in Mr. Tellez's yard. Mr. Tellez would like set his clock by the dog's intestines or something. You know how he pooped. It got to the point where this was going on for literally months. Mr. Tellez could not deal with this. He just couldn't. So he decided he's going to kill, this being Miami, the guy, not the dog, okay? I mean, any other place in the world, they would kill the dog, right? Not in Miami. He kills the guy, okay? So he kills the guy, but he didn't want to get caught for it. Now, Mr. and Mrs. Tellez had been on a budget, as I said before. They were sort of humble people, and he used to go to the grocery and buy cheap cuts of meat, marinate them, and so there would be... Oh, no, you don't know the end of this. You have no idea what's coming. Okay, so then, so he, you know, he kills, I can't remember, I have to go back and look at my files, but I haven't talked about this story in a long, long time, except they asked me in the other place. So he kills the personal trainer and said, but, you know, all this while the wife was at work, obviously, who doesn't want to get caught. So he buries him, and he chops him up, and he buries him in the backyard. But then he's scared. He said, I'm going to get caught, you know, having killed the gentleman in the backyard. So he decides he's going to barbecue him. But the personal he tries to barbecue him. It doesn't work because the personal trainer worked out, you know, to work out a lot, so he had no body fat. You know, you got to have body fat to be barbecued. So then... I am not making this up, okay? So then he decides to barbecue the personal trainer, and he gets his barbecue, chops him up, no, marinates him for a day. I forgot about the marinade. Marinates him for a day, and so the fibers break up of the personal trainer. And then he barbecues him, and then he takes the bones and buries them in the back. At this point, he had obviously shrunk the personal trainer, so the personal trainer was very small. So he buries him in the back. I know you're saying no, but this is a case, okay? I could not make this up. Even me, I could not. So he buries him in the back. So the police come around to find out what happens to the personal trainer. Guess who's in the backyard digging up the personal trainer? There, I wrote it up as a short story. I could not make this up, okay? So I wrote to myself, I said, how jaded am I being a PI? At that point, I'd seen everything. I mean, I had like seen everything in Miami. So I write down on this yellow pad. You can't take very much with you to the jail, just, you know, something to write with in a pen. So I write down, because my husband at that point had been looking, you know, he loved to barbecue. So I wrote down, get the recipe. And that's the day I quit. I said, how can I be so shallow? You know, how can I be so awful? The next day I sat down, figuring after 10 years I had enough information. I wrote what became Bloody Waters, the first book. And the book sold. I got an agent in New York, and the book sold in 2 days. I had a two-book deal for too much money. I shouldn't say that, but it's a lot easier if you get paid on the back end than the front end. Then I had another two-book deal. Then I sold the movie and TV rights. And that was my Lupe Solano start in life. But I paid my dues, and I, you know, did what I had to do to get that done. And my seventh book was One Hot Summer, which was a love story. But being me, it was about adultery. So, you know, love story about adultery. Because in Lupe Solano, my motto was three bodies per book or you get your money back. So you can follow the progression as to how the book is going by how many bodies there are. Because I'm pretty gruesome. And so I wrote that. And then HarperCollins, who published, was my publisher. Well, I had my first three books with Putnam's and my last ones with HarperCollins. And they came to me and they said that they were having a new genre, a new editorial, you know, input. And they wanted me to write for them. It was called Rayo, and they wanted Latino writers who wrote in English. And I was one of the 10 that they... I was very honored. I was one of the 10 that they chose. So I wrote the One Hot Summer, but they didn't want a mystery. They didn't. They wanted something brand new. And I said to my agent, I was with a pretty high-powered agent at that time, and I said, give me bullet points. You know, what do you want me to write with a love story? I mean, that's so out of my league. And he gave me 10 bullet points. I wrote all the 10 bullet points. I wrote the story. And, you know, as I said, I'm not used to writing because... you know, about a love story where there are two people in bed and they're both breathing. So it's kind of hard for me not to kill people, you know, in this book. But they made a movie, you know, so why not? If you all have insomnia, it's still on Lifetime Television at night. They still play it. So based on my book, it's called One Hot Summer. They play at like 4 in the morning for insomniacs. And that tells you how good the book, the movie. Anywho, I went to a premiere in L.A. It was cool. They had actually have a red carpet, and they had all the thing, and there were movie stars. I was thrilled. So I'm easily impressionable. So then my eighth book was set in Las Vegas. It was Luck of the Draw. It was about the Cuba when before Fidel Castro, they had a lot of gambling, and it was the mob ran it. It was Meyer Lansky and his group from the Caribbean. Caribbean. And when the Castro took over, he closed down the casinos. And I thought it was very interesting because the mob offered all the people that had worked in the casinos in Havana jobs in Vegas. So that's, they went to Vegas. And that's why there's such a large Cuban community in Las Vegas, which I did not know about. Also, Catholic charities who used to repatriate Cubans from Cuba once they landed in Miami and settled them in the States, for some unknown reason, decided Las Vegas was a place to place them. So you had the ones from the casinos, and then you had the ones that the Cuban charities settled in Las Vegas. So there's a large Cuban community in Las Vegas, and I decided to set a book there. My other book, my ninth, I guess, was Another Lupe Solano, and my tenth is Here We Get to Magnolia, which is about sex and sports, which everyone wants to know about, I guess. It's about a girl from Minneapolis. Minneapolis is the biggest sports town in the U.S. I did actually research on this. And they have more amateur teams and professional teams than any other city in the States. Must be the weather, I don't know. But that's what I surmise. Anyway, it's about a young girl from Minneapolis who comes to Miami with her absolutely good-for-nothing boyfriend, and the book starts with her sitting in a sports bar because she knows a lot about sports because she has four older brothers and all that, and she has to decide, does she go back to Minneapolis with her tail between her legs because her family all said, don't do it, don't go to Miami, your boyfriend's a piece of, you know, nothing, and this and that and the other thing, but she, you know, went anyway. So she has to make a decision. Do I go back to Minneapolis, tail between my legs, the whole thing a disaster? And it's the old I told you so's when you're 21 years old, you know, that's not so good. And, or do I stay in Miami, try to make a go of it, forget that I really want, my ambition is to get a job as a, doing something with history of, she was a history of art major, and what she wanted to do. And unfortunately, her major was even more pathetic, was the Impressionists, you know. I mean, if you really want to starve, major in the Impressionists, you know, that's, which I love, is my favorite period, so I get to put that in there. So anyway, so she meets a woman, the book opens up one night, she's in a sports bar, she has to make up, one afternoon, sorry, in August, she has to make up her mind, does she go back to Minneapolis, or does she stay in Miami and take a waitressing job, or as a stripper, or as something, and as she's sitting there, this 40-ish-year-old woman, very well-dressed, comes and sits next to her, starts to talk to her, and it turns out that she's a sports agent and makes her an offer, say, please spend one more day with me, and then tomorrow, I mean, in Miami, and then tomorrow come to my office, and I will make you an offer, and you've somehow been placed in front of me, and I don't know why you're in my life. There's some reason why you're here, and I'm here at 3 o'clock in the afternoon drinking. You know, that's not normal for either of us, I can tell. So Magnolia says, why not? You know, the next day she shows up at the sports agent's, who's a lawyer's office, and the sports agent makes her an offer that for her to think about, which is that she become as a sports geisha. In other words, she has to keep happy, as they say, her the sports agent's clients, and be happy is what you exactly what you think it is. So I write up, it's a part of the first part of the book is the training that Magnolia went through to become a sports agent. She had to learn Spanish. She met with a sports psychologist to know the kind of pressure that these young athletes are under, which is huge. I mean, I actually, believe it or not, did a lot of research for this book, and not just for the sex part. I mean, I did a lot of research for the sports psychologist, because that really fascinated me. I met with the psychologist that counsels the Miami Heat players, and as well as a lady in Virginia that she wrote a book on all this. So I really actually did real research on this. And these young men come from pretty humble backgrounds for the most part. And all of a sudden, they come into these enormous sums of money. I mean, enormous sums of money. And people pray on them. I mean, that's basically what happens. You know, the family shows up and they buy the Rolls Royces and the this and the huge cars, and they all, for some unknown reason, invest in restaurants. Really, I don't know why, but they all invest in restaurants, like steakhouses. I mean, you know, whatever. And so, but it, no, it's a real truth. And they always have the fear of being injured over them, because anything happens to them and they're out of the game, it's over. They could be 21 years old and basically ruined for life with the kind of injuries that they can, you know, go under. So the sports psychologist tells Magnolia about the kind of pressures these guys are under and all that. The third part of her training is she meets a stylist, she gets her hair done, she goes manicures and pedicures and a bikini wax, you know, things like that, that prepare her for this. Also, she has to go to a gym to train, because it's going to take a lot of effort for what she's going to be doing. She's got to be in shape. So that's the middle part of the book. The last part of the book is I have 12 sports, and it's why she has to meet with the particular athletes of the particular sports. In other words, I start off with, and for some reason, I have a website, and people can contact the author from my website. I cannot tell you how many comments I've gotten about this particular. There are 12 ways she has sex with the different elite athletes. You know about ice sex? You who live in a cold area, ice sex? Okay, ice sex, for some reason, is just rather remarkable. It's the athlete that comes to her. Are you okay? Oh, you covered your ears?
No, are you saying ice?
Ice, like pieces of ice cubes? Oh, I thought you were covering your ears. Okay. If you want, I can stop. I can stop. I thought you were going over here. I'm sorry. Oh, sorry. No. Little girl. So the first, I'm sorry. Okay, her first client was a Russian skater. He used to do one of those skates on ice, you know, one of those tour things. And he dropped his partner. And ever since then, he can't get back on the ice. It's like you can't get back on the horse or the bicycle, you know, after you fall. And so Magnolia has to somehow get him over his fear of dropping somebody or a partner or whatever. Well, the way she decides to do it is to take him to a ice skating rink that had been closed, and do certain things to him to, you know, I really blush easily, to get him to go back on the ice. Ice sex is something that is incredibly popular, which I had no idea about. Okay, yes. Part of the problem is that they ice skate naked, but they have skates on. You know what is on skates, right? The blades. Okay, so people cut themselves up having ice skates. Another problem that happens, and this is part of the attraction of this whole thing of ice skate, another problem is hypothermia, because they're all stark naked. So, and their private parts get frozen. There's frostbite, too. So, Magnolia, aren't you glad you came tonight? Okay. So it's how she has, you know, sex with this guy with the ice and, you know, the thing. I have 12 of these athletes, and that's boxing, because the boxer is all concerned about the ring girls and, you know, the ones that have the things that they walk around. So she has to cure him of their infatuation with the ring girls. Then I have snowboarding, which I love. So the snowboarder was a really interesting one. She has to dress up like a nurse and do little bad things. And then I did the research for the sports part, the sports psychology. For the sex part, the research was a little trickier. I never knew how normal I was until I started researching, and this is serious. I mean, it's amazing what people do, honestly. So for the part of the research is, we have an apartment in New York and in the West Village, and my middle daughter, Antonia, and I were having lunch there, and I said to her in the afternoon, this was a few months ago, I said, you want to go to a sex shop with me? And she said, she's 32, it's okay. So She said, what are we going to do? I said, we're going to find out about bondage. You want to come? And so she says, oh my God. Okay. So we go to the sex shop that's right down the street from us in the West Village. And I'm explaining to the owner, there's nobody there, like at 2 o'clock on a Tuesday. So we go there and I explain to the owner that I'm doing research for this book. The book is all about sex and I want to find out about bondage and all this kind of stuff. I'm not making this up. So the lady says to me, well, you should probably try with spanking. Start off with spanking. I go, spanking? Sure, fine. So she brings out this paddle, this all leather paddle with little holes in it and like things. And so she says to me, well, spanking, do you know how? I go, no, I never spanked my kids, but you know, obviously this is not that kind of spanking. So she says to Antonia, she says, here, do you want to spank your mother? So to teach her how to, it gets better. Okay, you want to spank your mother? So she, Antonia will back me up if she was here. So if you, like, you have to bend over. So I bend over and Antonia takes the paddle and starts to smack me. No, lower. So I know Antonia's looking at me going like, God. The lady says, well, if you really want to do it right, you have to wear a blindfold. So I said, do you have one? So she brings out the, I have props. She brings out, she brings out the blindfold. I put it on my, on like here. I'm now bending over. My daughter's now spanking me in a sex shop. And we both look at each other. What happened to our lives? You know? I'm not kidding you. I see, it still has a tag, so you know I don't use it very much. So that's the kind of research I did. Unfortunately, I was stupid because I didn't realize that one should never use one's proper email account to do research. Oh, well. The most fun I had, the most interesting one is I had, it was an invitation to join triplet grandmothers in the Philippines for a foursome. I'm not making this up. I mean, this is a weird life I'm in now. So thank God I never did anything with children or animals because that would have been just horrific. But, you know, for this stuff. But people are into just the most bizarre things. Honest to God. So that's my book. There's more. I do sumo. I do basketball, baseball. I have a lot of sports in there. Hi-Li. I love the Hi-Li. Hi-Li's good. You like Hi-Li? There's a lot of feathers in what they do. Feathers are involved. Well, anything else? Or thank you for coming very much. That's it. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Foden. We have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.